decades after the Royal African Company and other trade companies had well-established trade forts on the Gold Coast of Africa, a new empire was forming inland. Clans of the sub-Saharan rainforests of central Ghana began to unite into a single force. The Asante people would unite against a powerful nation to the south, the Denkyera Empire. The man who united them was Osei Tutu. And how did he unite all of these tribes against a common enemy? A golden stool.
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome back to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. Today I'm talking about the Asante Empire. This empire is native to northern Ghana and the surrounding states. According to oral history of the Asante people, the high priest Okomfo Anyoke summoned the golden stool from the sky. The stool came down and landed at the feet of Osei Tutu. Tutu would then become the first king of the Asante people. The golden stool has now been a symbol of strength for the Asante people and is represented as the centerpiece of the flag of the Asante. So the Asante people maintained that the stool descended from the sky in their oral tradition. This stool was likely created by a craftsman working closely with Okomfo Anyoke and Osei Tutu. And these tribes had a long tradition of working with gold and had several methods for applying it to the stool. In this case, the stool is made from a single block of Alstonia bune, which is a wood with spiritual importance to the Asante. Gold was applied to the stool through an inlaying process. They likely pounded the gold into the gold leaf and then attached the gold through carefully placed recesses or grooves pre-cut into the wood so that the gold could be applied to the surface. The stool would have been presented to these tribes, and the story of the stool descending to the Osei Tutu's feet would be repeated over and over to create political alliances and unify tribes into one large group. But let's dial things back a bit to understand Osei Tutu and how they got to that point. So Tutu and the people of this region in central and northern Ghana are part of the Akan culture. In their culture, there's the concept of an Abusua. Abusua is a maternal group of people. So it's basically your maternal lineage who share a common maternal ancestry. And there are eight main Abusua in Akan culture. There's the Oyoko, the Bretuo, Agona, Esona, Esiene, Essien, I think it's Essien, not Essiene, Eduana, Ekuono, and Asakiri. Osei Tutu was of the first group, the Oyoko. He was part of the, you'd say he's part of the Ayoka Abusua. His mother's lineage made him in line for the Kwaman throne. So at the time, the throne was held by his uncle, but he was next in line. So when he was 16 years old, this would have been about 1676. So if you listen to the last podcast, this is right in the midst of when the British and Dutch are really settling in and on their forts on the coast and ramping up their slavery operations and gold mining and trade operations along the coast. But just know that's kind of building elsewhere in the background. We won't really talk much about it here, but just to get some context. So Osei was taken as sort of a hostage to the current Denkyera Empire's royal court. So they would be to the south between where Osei Tutu was from and where all these Dutch and British forts would have been. So the Denkyera were like a buffer empire, but they were kind of controlling things. They were kind of the big empire at the time. But this was a common practice at the time to have these lesser nobility come and be sort of hostages at this royal court. They weren't treated like prisoners, though. They were more like subordinates under the rule of the Denkyura Empire. They did this to ensure the compliance and loyalty of their subordinate kings. They also did it to indoctrinate these young heirs in the kingdom to be loyal to the Denkyura Empire. You know, they take them into their court, get to know them, become friends with them, and that's going to keep them from turning on them, or so they would hope. And, you know, they're integrated with the court. They would retain loyalty to their imperial system this way, by keeping them in this court. And Osei Tutu was treated with respect, and he lived as a guest in the Denkyura Hene's palace. And the Denkyura Hene is like the leader of the Denkyura Empire. So he would socialize with elites and play games, and he'd learn their customs and ways of administration. He even rose to the position of shield bearer in the Denkyura court. He was a trusted asset, you might say. But then Tutu got himself into a bit of trouble. It almost sounds like a fairy tale in a way. He fell in love with the Denkyuran princess Ebensua, and then began a secret relationship. It was a secret because the princess was already married to a high-ranking Denkyura dignitary. To make matters worse, the princess became pregnant. Okay, that's probably where the Disney fairy tale ends. But there were rumors that Tutu might be the father. This would have meant that Tutu would have broken the Denkyura law, and he could be subject to execution. So with his life in danger and under the pressure from the princess herself, Tutu fled the palace to hide out in Akwamu, which was the state that was furthest east in the empire. So then he's welcomed into the court of Akwamu. Not sure how he really, you know, tricked his way. Look, I knocked up the princess of the Denkyura. Do you guys think I could come hang out here for a while? I'm not quite sure how he pulled that off. I didn't find information on that. But so at the court, so he would be now at the court of Sesraku I, who was their leader of the Akwamu. And he would learn the customs of now their group. And this would complement his knowledge of the Denkyura Empire. And he would also be taught about their military customs. So he was gaining this wider perspective. You know, he's got, well, they've got these administrative customs and they've got these administrative customs. But look, these guys have a more organized empire or more organized military, the Akwamu did. So he spent a few years in Akwamu until he heard that his uncle had passed away. Back in Kwamon, where he was from, that's where he was heir to the throne. So with his uncle dying, that means he needs to get his butt back there and take over and retain leadership of his kingdom. So when he did return home, he brought some friends with him. Well, one friend in particular who he had met in Akwamu, and this was that high priest Okomfo Enokye. And I mean, these guys apparently were inseparable and just became best friends and were very like-minded. So by the time Tutu's uncle died, he had gotten to know Enyoke, and they shared this resentment towards the Denkyuran Empire. Enyoke's mother had been killed at the hands of Denkyuran priests, and he resented them for it. Tutu himself, of course, had also witnessed the poor treatment of the non-Denkyuran people while he was at court in the Denkyuran Empire. And these two men would bond over their feelings of resentment towards the Denkyura and become inseparable friends. So now with the best friend by his side, Osei Tutu would begin to form a confederacy to stand against the Denkyuran Empire. The Amantu Confederation, or the Kwamen Clan States is what it was called. The capital of this new alliance was Kwamon, which was then renamed Kumasi. By Osei Tutu. He renamed the capital. Wow, how nice of him. So the two men, Tutu and Enyoke, are both credited as founders of this confederacy, and they both kind of deserve a great deal of credit for its creation. They sort of rallied everybody together. It seems like it was a really good partnership. So they didn't immediately create the empire right out of the Confederacy, though. It took quite a while. From around 1680 to around 1695, Tutu and Enoki would continue to organize and gain strength for their Confederacy. So it's not clear which tribes joined in which order, but there was mostly made up of other Akan peoples, and they were brought together either through diplomacy or warfare. One source did say that the Abuso people were the first to switch allegiances from the Denki or Ehene to Osetutu. Now, at some point here, around 1695, Okomfo Enoki created the Golden Stool. And to give you an idea of what the stool looked like, obviously it was covered in gold. But the stool looks like it's about a foot tall, maybe, and it has a seat on it that is fairly wide, and it sort of flares up on the ends, but it's kind of neat looking. And oftentimes when they present it, it's like laying face down with the seat towards people, and it actually has, the stool itself has a chair that it sits on. There's pictures of it online, and it's kind of interesting, but it sits next to the leader. So the leader is sitting in his chair, and then next to him, the golden stool is sitting on its own chair. So the legend that begins to be spread by Okomfo Enoki is that the stool descended from the heavens and landed at Osetutu's feet. So this tale helped to solidify and unify the Asante as an empire and not just a loose confederacy. They really attached themselves to this story. And it's just, this is kind of clever to me because they didn't just say, hey, everyone, unite under this Osetutu because he's a great leader. And, you know, Okomfo Enoki could have just said, well, he was chosen. You know, he could have made up a different myth or something, but he did this golden stool. That way they were united under an idol and not just a person. And that makes it a little less, oh, well, he's from that tribe and I hold prejudices against that tribe. You know, it was less, they'd probably have less prejudices going into the alliance. Oh, well, we're uniting over the golden stool. We're not uniting over that guy from Kumasi. But, you know, as the time goes on, his legend would grow along with the stools. And that's how the myth building starts to work. And he starts to really gain a powerful empire this way. So this legend and myth building, you know, it begins to work. All these smaller chiefdoms that had been a loose confederacy, yeah, they just really attached themselves to this golden stool. So anyway, so now armed with political and military knowledge, as well as the commitment of a newly formed empire, the Asante would take on the Dankieran Empire. And it's worth noting that some sources still cite them as the Amantu at this point, and it's kind of cited like they were named Asante as a result of their conflict with the Dankieran Empire. But we're looking at it from the future, looking to the past, so we know they will become the Asante. So for simplicity, I'm just going to refer to them as the Asante as to not be confusing. So the Asante goaded the Dankierans into battle after refusing to pay an increased gold tax that was demanded by the Denkiura Hene. The king of the Denkiura, Nitim Gyakari, and he was pretty young leader. He had only just started leading the empire the same year that the Golden Stool myth arose. So it had been 1695. So much of the reason for Osetutu's rise also seems to be that this Nitim Gyakari was just a terrible leader and somewhat of a demanding tyrant. European observers described him as a capricious young man of uncertain judgment. So the refusal to pay this increased tax led to Denkiura advancing forces and driving Asante troops out of Adunku, Ebotem, and Oputogwa. And this was actually part of Tutu's plan. It was sort of a feint, right? He wanted to draw them in. He wanted to bring this large force from the Dankiura Empire into an area where they could control the attack have an ambush. And that's exactly what they did. So they led him into Fies, F-E-Y-I-A-S-E, Fies. I should have looked it up. And he would then ambush them with the full force of the Asante Empire. So like many military victories, the Asante surprised the enemy on their flanks, and it was just too late for them to reposition and take on the surprise attack. They ended up being completely surrounded, and most of the Denkyera would have been killed in this battle. It is a very decisive battle. It's called the Battle of the Fies, and it was just a decisive victory for the Asante people. The battle itself was fought with a variety of weapons. So remember, this battle took place in 1701. I don't know that I mentioned that, actually. It took place in 1701. So this is 6 years into the empire. So there had been some tension building up over time. I sort of glossed over that. But the important thing to note is that the Asante were growing in power. The Denkyera leadership was failing, and it was pretty obvious that something was going to come to a head. But this is 1701, so the technology was in the midst of a strange transition from traditional weapons to more modern weapons. So the Denkyera had access to Dutch cannons and many firearms. They would have also fought with swords and spears and bows and arrows, though. But the Asante side, they would have no cannons and a limited supply of guns. But they would also fight with swords, spears, and bows and arrows as well. So they didn't win to any advantage of weapons. You know, they were clearly disadvantaged in that regard, which is probably why the Denkyeran leadership thought that, you know, he probably just waved his hand, just said, go deal with this, put these guys down. Obviously, they're outgunned. We should be able to take them easily. But he lacked any military tactics, it would appear to, you know, seem. It seems like so many battles in history that were decisive, it's like, well, they had superior military tactics. And a lot of times to me, it seems like, well, the other side was just caught with their pants down and they just weren't, you know, they didn't put any military tactics into place. Like they should have been a little more careful about the way they moved their troops. So because of this terrible defeat, Gyokari is sometimes referred to as the king who gifted his land to his enemies. So it was that bad of a defeat. Pretty ridiculous. But there's an interesting side to this. And I really struggled to find out if it was definitively true. I don't know that there's a way to know for sure. One of the Asante's leaders is, at the end of this battle, it's said that one of the Asante leaders found Nitim Gyokari, and he's off in some tent or something, messing around with some woman nearby. Unconcerned about the battle, because he was assumed, you know, he thought he was just going to steamroll over these Asante and get his gold and go home. You know, teach him a lesson and go home. That he wasn't there to go to some great battle. He was there to conquer and put people in their place. But the bombshell here, so he's taken to Gyokari. This guy Gyokari is taken to Osei's feet for judgment. And the bombshell here is that it's possible that Tim Gyokari was actually the son of none other than the princess Akobina Abensua. I don't know that I said her full name before, but her full name was Princess Akobina Abensua. And the father of this child might have been Osei Tutu himself. In other words, they think it's possible that Nitim Gyokari was this baby that the princess was pregnant with when Osei Tutu had fled the Denkyera court all those years before. And that makes Gyokari his son. And I really want to believe this, but I can't find enough evidence to say that that's for sure. There was a few, I think it was mentioned in Wikipedia and one other source, but one of the sources that Wikipedia references is gone. So I couldn't find that. And then the other source, it was really offhanded. But then other things, it's just very unsure about this. But it would make, I mean, it sort of tracks because, like I said, he was young. He would have been about 18 years old at the time, I believe. So that's roughly, you know, they said he was, remember, those Europeans called him a capricious young man. That sounds like an 18-year-old if I ever knew one. But remember, much of this is passed down through oral tradition. So things could sometimes get mixed around or maybe embellished a little bit. You know, it is a great story if it's true, but I'm just going to imagine this is as true as the golden stool actually descended from the sky. Okay, so take that however you want. So in any case, it sounds like neither of these men knew that they were related at the time. That's the really sad part, is they didn't know that they were related. He didn't realize, apparently, that this was the princess's son. I find that interesting that he wouldn't know that, but okay. This would kind of make a hell of a fantasy novel, wouldn't it? It's just, it's kind of a sad story, though, for them to meet up like this and not know each other, and then he's executed right then and there. So now the Denkyura are scattered and leaderless, and the capital of the Denkyuran Empire, Ebenkeseso, was undefended. There are differing accounts of when and how it happened, but the Denkyura city was definitely ransacked and stripped of all valuables, with much of them going to Kumasi, the Emetu/Asante capital. I mentioned that Denkyura had access to Dutch cannons. These were actually gifted to the Denkyura by the Dutch East India Company to defeat the Asante. The Dutch had been working with the Denkyura to trade, presumably for gold and slaves, for years. So the Dutch wanted to help out their business partners. When the Asante defeated the Denkyura, the Dutch were then forced to now deal with the Asante Empire themselves in their slave trade, and obviously gold trade as well, and other trade, just trade in general. But both the Denkyura and the Asante would have had some kind of dealings with Europeans before this war. But after the war, the Asante Empire was kind of the big guy to have to deal with. And they encompassed much of modern-day Western Ghana and large portions of Eastern Ivory Coast. So now that the Asante is running things and growing, they grow and grow in power. They're putting down pockets of uprisings from the Denkyura until about 1707, but then this empire would continue to grow. The Asante gained control over all of the gold fields in the area, allowing them to purchase modern weapons from Europeans. So they're trading in gold. And then upon a later leader, Opoku Ware, this would be Osetutu's successor, the empire expands northwards, conquering the Banaman, the Gonja, and the Dagomba by 1730. So they're really expanding. And this Dagomba became a client state, supplying over 1,000 slaves annually to the Asante. So from 1730 to 1777, the empire expands northward. Hold on, think about that though. Okay, so by 1730, this Dagomba becomes a client state and is supplying 1,000 slaves to the Asante annually. Okay, so that means, okay, so now 1730 to 1770, let's assume they kept doing that. That's 40 straight years where they're sending around 1,000 slaves out of Dagomba every, yeah, so 40,000 slaves over that time period. That is just a lot of people to be forced to move, and just, it's just kind of wild to me. So now from 1730 to 1770, the empire had expanded northward more, and it conquered the savannah states of Gonja, Dagbon, and Krakye. And by 1816, the Asante had absorbed coastal states and become the major slave trader with Europeans. And this is kind of where our story will pick up next week. The Asante are going to begin to have disputes with Europeans over the coastal forts that the British still maintain. This would flare up into full-blown war between the British and the Asante, known as the Anglo-Asante Wars. Where the podcast goes from there is still a mystery. We'll try to find a trail that leads us back to friendlier pastures, you know, maybe less violence. But I really enjoyed learning about the Asante. This is kind of something that my history class never really delved into much. There was almost like this veil, like every year you'd learn a little bit about, you know, if you start learning about U.S. history, well, you learn about the history of slavery, or at least you used to. I don't know what the hell they do now. But anyway, like, used to learn about the history of slavery, but that history kind of stopped at the African coast. We would basically learn what Europeans were doing. It was kind of racist in a way, because it was like, well, where did these slaves come from? What kind of people were they? What was their culture like? And you really didn't learn it. I don't remember learning hardly anything about it. I knew about slave forts on the coast, but I didn't know anything. It was just like a veil that you couldn't get through or see through. So this was really fun for me to learn. I hate to say fun because it's like war and violence and slavery, but it's just interesting to learn about people that you never really got a chance to learn about before. I think I've heard about some golden stool or something, you know, but, you know, I don't have I'm not the best at geography and stuff. So, like, I couldn't probably tell you which part of Africa that was from. So it was really interesting to me to learn more about that. But, and we'll continue that next week. It's likely we'll probably take the podcast over to the Caribbean. I haven't quite decided yet. I really want to go over to the Caribbean because then I can talk about pirates. But I think we might be, we're at least in Africa for one more episode. And then we'll see where we go from there. It depends on what kind of interesting information we learn from these Anglo-Asante wars. Hopefully it's not just body counts and this and that. I already know a pretty interesting factoid about a gilded skull of an Irishman that this guy has a pretty interesting story. He's probably going to be a prominent character in next week's episode. But all right, well, thank you so much for listening, though. For now, this has been Meridians. I am Charlie Noble, and thank you for listening.